Right, well, the science delusion is the belief that science already understands the nature of reality in principle, leaving only the details to be filled in. And that's the title of my new book. And what I'm doing in this book is essentially arguing that there's a conflict in modern science between the ideals of science, free inquiry, skepticism, exploration, attention to evidence, and the actual practice of science, which has, in my opinion, become trapped in the dogmas of a worldview. And that worldview is materialism, which has dominated science since the late 19th century. Materialism is the belief that all reality is material or physical, that the world's mechanistic, it's a machine made up of inanimate matter. Nature is purposeless. Consciousness is nothing but the activity of the brain. And God is an idea in minds and hence in brains. This is a very familiar worldview. It's the default position of most educated people in Britain today. And it's taken for granted as part of the package of science. When I was being educated as a scientist, I absorbed this worldview by osmosis. Nobody ever said, here are the actual beliefs in this worldview. I didn't even realize it was a worldview. I just thought it was the truth. And many materialists aren't aware that this is a philosophy which hasn't always dominated science. They're not aware that it's something that rests on assumptions which have hardened into dogmas, because it's so rarely discussed within institutional science, or indeed anywhere else. So it's basically a set of assumptions, because most of them haven't been proved. And Sir Karl Popper, the philosopher of science, said that what materialism really amounts to is a stance, which he called promissory materialism. It involves issuing undated promissory notes against future explanations, which will justify the beliefs. This is not a polemical talk. What I'm trying to do is to look at the basic assumptions of materialism. There are 10 basic dogmas, or assumptions, if you don't like the word dogma, or beliefs. And what I'm doing is turning them into questions. And I'm going to look at them in a scientific spirit. The kind of spirit of skepticism that's cultivated throughout the scientific world, and particularly strongly in this particular research unit here. Skepticism, looking at these assumptions, how do they stack up against the evidence? Are they true? And this is an ideal which underlies science altogether. It's an idealization in many ways. Here's a summary of it by Ricky Gervais, the comedian, who was asked to do an article about his atheist belief system in the Wall Street Journal a couple of years ago. And after denouncing religion, he then contrasted it with science. Those are the bad guys, these are the good guys, and what makes science good is this. As he said, science seeks the truth, and it does not discriminate. For better or worse, it finds things out. Science is humble. It knows what it knows, and it knows what it doesn't know. It bases its conclusions and beliefs on hard evidence, evidence that's constantly updated and upgraded. It doesn't get offended when new facts come along. It embraces the body of knowledge. Well, I'm going to take that ideal seriously and apply it to the basic dogmas or assumptions of science. And the first one is everything is essentially mechanical. This is the basic assumption on which the whole mechanistic worldview has been based since the 17th century. The question becomes, is nature mechanical? Now, this assumption in the 17th century was brought about by making the machine the central metaphor for everything in nature. And the reason that the scientific revolution of the 17th century was revolutionary is it was rejecting an older worldview, which was that nature was essentially organic. That the older view saw nature as an organism. The whole universe was like an organism. Suns and stars were like organisms. The Earth was like an organism, Mother Earth. Animals and plants were living beings with souls. This is what was taught in medieval universities following Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas. The soul is what shaped the body in the case of animals and plants and humans. It gave the body its form. It attracted the developing organism towards its mature state. In addition, animals had what St. Thomas Aquinas called the animal soul, and Aristotle called it that too, which gave them their instincts, underlay their sensitivity, coordinated their movements and behavior. And of course, the word animal comes from the Latin word anima, meaning soul. And humans had a vegetative soul like plants that shaped the body, an animal soul that gave us our animal nature, our animal instincts, our animal senses and physiology. And in addition, the spiritual soul, or the rational soul, which was to do with thought, language, the higher things of the mind, and which was open to the Spirit of God. Now, that was the worldview that the mechanistic revolution was a revolution against. And what it did was to say, no, that's completely wrong. There are no such things as souls except the human rational soul. All of nature is essentially mechanical, machine-like. The universe is like a machine, and animals and plants are just machines, mechanisms with no minds, no feelings, just mechanisms. The human body is just a machine too, and the only thing that makes humans different from everything else is the presence of the rational mind, which is not material, it's spiritual. And it's akin to the nature of God and the angels. It's spiritual, the body's material. Well, this was the famous Cartesian dualism, creating a split between mind and body, and also between humans and nature, because no other animals had souls or minds. So what it did essentially was change the old view, which was that organisms are self-organizing. They have their own purposes, and they have their own formative principles. What this did was said that the nature, it chopped off purposes and formative principles and left bodies as just having movement and material, moving causes, what Aristotle called efficient causes, what we now call energy, and matter. The purposes and the designs of everything in nature were taken out of nature and put into the mind of God. The founders of modern science were all devout Christians, and they thought that this mechanistic view increased the importance of God. They were not atheists at all. They thought by taking purpose and design out of organisms and putting it into God, God would then be like a kind of supreme designer of the machinery of life. And so it involved a revolution in theology too, because God now took on the role as this mechanical, engineering, mathematical designer of things. So that's how this worldview came into being. And it was essentially a shift to this metaphor of the machine. But it's only a metaphor. It doesn't really prove. It's not tested. It's not a testable theory. You can do an experiment. You can refute it. It's just a metaphor. And many people have argued since then, especially in the 20th century, that for understanding nature, the metaphor of organism, the old metaphor, is much better. Nature is much more like an organism. We're more like organisms than we are like machines. The mechanistic view says that we're just, in Richard Dawkins' phrase, lumbering robots, and our minds are nothing but genetically programmed computers, the software of computers operating in our brains. But the metaphor of organism is actually more appropriate for most of nature. David Hume was one of those who, rather surprisingly, put this forward rather forcefully. In his Dialogues on Natural Religion, Hume questioned the idea of the universe being mechanical, which was used as an argument for the existence of God. He thought it was a very bad metaphor. And when he talks about the whole universe, he suggested the world could have originated from something like a seed or an egg. It's more like an organism. He said, "There are other parts of the universe besides the machines of human invention which bear still a greater resemblance to the fabric of the world and which therefore afford a better conjecture concerning the universal origin of the system. These parts are animals and plants. The world plainly resembles more an animal or a vegetable than it does a watch or a knitting loom. And does not a plant or an animal which springs from vegetation or generation bear a stronger resemblance to the world than does any artificial machine which arises from reason and design. The machine metaphor, you see, almost inevitably conjures up an intelligent design kind of argument, which Hume was trying to get rid of. But the idea that the universe could have originated from something like a seed or an egg was in fact completely rejected by science until 1966, when the Big Bang theory became orthodox. The Big Bang theory tells us the universe started very small, less than the size of a head of a pin, very hot, and it's been growing, cooling, differentiating ever since, far more like a growing organism on a vast scale than like any machine we're familiar with. The Big Bang theory was first proposed in 1927 by Father George Lemaître, a Roman Catholic priest and astronomer, and was treated with grave suspicion by many scientists. It was endorsed by one of the popes in the 1950s, and that made the situation even worse. The proponents of the Big Bang theory were regarded as trying to smuggle Christianity back into science, and they were treated with extreme skepticism by most astronomers and cosmologists who were atheists or agnostics. However, the Big Bang theory won out because of the evidence in the end, and it's now almost unquestioned orthodoxy. And it certainly gives us a view of the universe much more like an organism than a machine. This mechanistic view, as I say, is just a metaphor. It doesn't prove anything one way or the other. It's a way of looking at things. But from it flow a huge number of assumptions which form the foundations of science as we know it. It leads directly to the next dogma: all matter is unconscious. And that turns into the question, is matter unconscious? All matter was unconscious in the 17th century because it was defined as unconscious. Matter was split off from consciousness, which only existed in human minds, which were non-material, according to Descartes. And so matter was defined as being unconscious. That's what it was. No one proved it. It was just an assumption, a definition. And science was essentially dualistic until the 19th century. Most scientists were quite happy to treat nature as mechanical, so were most theologians. As long as the human soul or mind remained separate from it all and part of the spiritual being of the universe, akin to God. The materialist revolution in philosophy was really to reject this dualism. For a lot of people, to have a dualism was offensive. They just wanted to have one. They wanted one thing, not two. For them, two was too many. From my point of view, two's too few. But if you have the idea two's too many, you can only go in one of two directions. First, that everything's material, that's materialism. Or secondly, that everything's mental, that's idealism, where consciousness is the only reality and matter somehow arises from it. But this dualistic attitude, when it turned into materialism, denied anything was conscious. And that, of course, left the glaring problem of human consciousness, because at least we're conscious. And this led materialists to try and deny or explain away human consciousness as nothing but the activity of the brain. It's a very unpersuasive view on the face of it, and Francis Crick called it the astonishing hypothesis. This is what Crick said. You, your joys and your sorrows, your memories and your ambitions, your sense of personal identity and free will are, in fact, no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. Well, presumably Crick made an exception for himself, because if he didn't, then his materialist beliefs would have just been there because his brain made him believe them. And presumably he wants us to believe that they were true, not just something he was forced to believe. But this has caused enormous problems, and it's a very well-known problem in the philosophy of mind and in consciousness studies. It's in fact known in the trade to philosophers of mind as the hard problem. The very existence of consciousness is the hard problem. There have been many attempts to explain it away as an illusion in one form or another, but these attempts don't even convince other materialists. That's why there's so many alternative theories. And we're left in this kind of limbo of a belief system which both defies our own personal experience and is rather incoherent as a philosophy. Some materialists have broken ranks. One of them is Galen Strawson, who published an article a few years ago in the Journal of Consciousness Studies called "Does Materialism Imply Panpsychism?" And Strawson argues that materialism, to be coherent, has to admit there's a kind of mind or consciousness in matter at all levels of complexity, even atoms and electrons. This, of course, is a controversial theory, but it's not a new one. And Descartes' dualism was opposed right from the beginning by philosophers. In the 17th century, Leibniz proposed that nature was made up of monads, which were units, basic units, which were both bodies and minds, and each monad reflected the whole universe from its point of view. Spinoza argued that everything in nature, the material side of nature, was associated with a mental side as well, and that what he called God or nature was both body and mind. In the 20th century, Alfred North Whitehead was the great philosopher of organism who argued that nature is best seen as organisms. Electrons and atoms are best seen as organisms, patterns of activity, processes, rather than static things. And he took the view that there's a mental pole and a physical pole, even in atoms and electrons. The atoms and electrons have feelings. They're attracted or repelled by things, to take the most basic of them. And this, you may think, is simply a metaphorical use of language. But Whitehead fleshed out his theory in a very interesting way. He thought that the difference between the mental and the physical pole of things was not so much a relation in space, with the mind being the inside and the mind and it, the body the outside, but a relation in time, that the physical pole of things was caused by causation from the past, what we normally think of as causation, energetic causation from the past, whereas the mental pole was in the future and worked the other way in time, that the mental pole was a realm of potentialities, potential futures, ends and goals and purposes that somehow worked from this virtual future back towards the past through the present. So there were two causal chains working in opposite directions. A very suggestive and interesting philosophy, and one that's not really been developed that much since Whitehead proposed it. I myself think it's the best hope of resolving the mind-body problem. And it's part of this more general panpsychist view of nature. So the idea that all matter's unconscious as a dogma or an assumption is just that, a dogma or an assumption, and the really interesting discussions going on both within materialist philosophy and elsewhere are really looking at what are the roots of consciousness even in inanimate systems like electrons and atoms. So again, it's an assumption, it's an open question. My point is not one side's right, the other's wrong. I'm just saying it's an open question. And simply to assume it is simply to take a dogma for granted. The next assumption is that the total amount of matter and energy is always the same. This is the law of conservation of matter and energy. All of us learned it at school. And this seems one of the most certain things in the whole of science. It's almost never discussed because it's almost universally assumed to be unquestionably true. This turns into the question, is the total amount of matter and energy always the same? When we ask that question and think about it a little bit, it becomes clear that the idea that the amount's the same is not something that's been proved. It's something that was assumed from the outset on theological and philosophical grounds. In ancient Greece, the proto-materialists, the atomists, believed that eternal reality was made up of matter, lots of little particles, the atoms, and that the atoms by definition couldn't be split up or divided. Therefore, they stayed the same indefinitely, forever. Therefore, the total number of atoms was always the same. Therefore, the total amount of matter was implicitly always the same. This wasn't based on delicate measurements on torsion balances to many places of decimals. It was a philosophical assumption, a very brilliant philosophical idea and a very fruitful one, but an assumption. And in the 17th century, when the founders of mechanistic science assumed that God made the machinery of the world in the first place, Descartes and others assumed that when God did that, he imparted to nature a fixed amount of motion of divine origin and therefore eternal, like the divine nature. And therefore the total amount of motion, or energy, as it was later called, was always the same. It was a theological assumption. Do scientists themselves take these assumptions very seriously? Well, most of them treat them with awed reverence and don't question them. I didn't myself, although I've questioned many of the dogmas of materialism. Until 2 years ago, I'd never questioned this one. I just assumed it must be true. And I thought in this book I ought to include it, and it might prove the exception to the rule. It might be the one dogma that turned out to be absolutely true and beyond all shadow of doubt. In fact, when I started thinking about it, I came to the conclusion it's the shakiest of them all. Within physics itself, in modern cosmology, the idea that there's a fixed amount of matter and energy may still be there as a residual belief, but in practice, physicists ignore it. Since the 1980s, they found that galaxies hung together much too well if you were going to explain them in terms of the gravitational attraction of their parts, stars, planets, etc. And that galaxies interacted with each other in a way that suggested they had far more matter than you would get from just adding up all the matter within them with realistic assumptions about brown dwarfs and invisible planets and so forth. So to make the equations balance and the whole thing hang together, they hypothesized dark matter, large amounts of it, just the right amount to make the equations balance and the galaxies hold together. There's no independent evidence for this dark matter. It's a hypothesis. And there's more than five times as much as normal matter, according to current theories in physics. Some people are trying to get rid of dark matter by modifying, by tweaking the laws of gravitation, and they hope that if they can do that, then the dark matter will disappear like a mirage. Well, if dark matter in vast quantities can be conjured out of nowhere by physicists and could disappear like a mirage, does the law of conservation of matter apply to dark matter? Well, evidently not. The amount is variable at will to make the equations balance. When we come to dark energy, that was postulated in the late 1990s. It's now a standard part of cosmology. People used to think that the universe would expand and the amount of matter in it, greatly augmented by the hypothesis of dark matter, would then cause it to slow down and eventually start contracting until it all imploded in the reverse of the Big Bang, known as the Big Crunch. But observations showed the universe is not slowing down. If anything, it's speeding up. And so in order to explain its continued expansion and accelerating expansion, a new form of energy was put in to the universe called dark energy to push it apart. So suddenly there was a huge amount of extra energy conjured out of nowhere to make the equations balance. The evidence for it is that it makes the theories of physics work. And you can have just as much or just as little as you want to make the equations work. The equations say that the energy density of the universe is constant. That means that the amount per unit volume is the same, but the universe is expanding, so the total amount of energy, of dark energy, must be going up. The universe is a perpetual motion machine. Well, in this situation, we've now reached the point where 96% of reality is dark matter and dark energy, whose nature is literally obscure. So can we say the total amount of matter and energy is always the same? Could any of these obscure forms be converted into regular matter and energy? Could some of the regular matter and energy disappear into these invisible and undetectable forms? Maybe. Who knows? How can anyone be sure in this situation? When we come to living organisms, the situation gets, the plot thickens even further. All of us have been brought up to assume that living organisms obey the normal laws of physics and chemistry and the conservation of matter and energy. It's just an absolutely standard assumption, unquestioned. I didn't question it myself until very recently, as I said. Therefore, any talk by vitalists in the 19th century about vital energy, some special kind of energy, or talks by people from the Indian or Chinese traditions about prana or qi, other forms of energy, are at best using these words in a metaphorical sense. It can't possibly apply to real energy, which scientists have pinned down long ago. So what's the evidence that living organisms really obey the law of conservation of matter and energy? Well, in the 1840s, Hermann von Helmholtz, the great German scientist, and better known for his work in physics, was a medical student in Berlin. And at that time, the idea was that vital energy was a key thing in living organisms, a different kind of energy from regular mechanical energy. Helmholtz took against this. He was a convinced mechanist, and he wanted to prove that living organisms are just machines. And he wanted to get rid of the spectre of vitalism once and for all from science. So he started out trying to prove that they obeyed the law of conservation of energy by doing experiments with making frogs' legs twitch with electrical stimuli and measuring the heat produced. But his instruments were too crude to get any meaningful measurements, so he adopted a theoretical approach. He argued that, of necessity, the cause must equal the effect. Therefore, the energy before and after must be the same. Therefore, living organisms must be just like machines, and therefore they must obey the principles of conservation of energy. He assumed what he set out to prove, and this then became the standard belief in biology. No one actually tried to test it with human beings till 1899, when two American nutritionists, Atwater and Benedict, decided to test it using a calorimeter, putting people in a box. They measured every bit of CO2 and oxygen, urine, feces, food in, food out, energy, exercise, work done, etc., in order to try and prove it. This is what they said in the introduction to their 1899 paper. That the law of the conservation of matter applies within the living organism, no one would doubt. It might seem equally certain that the metabolism of energy within the body takes place in accordance with the law of conservation of energy. The quantitative demonstration is, however, desirable. Not a test, a demonstration. And when their first experiments gave the wrong result, they changed the correction factors so they got the right result. Even though they got the right result, when they went on doing measurements, especially with people who were fasting and doing exercise, they got major discrepancies from the correct value. Also, with people who were eating too much and not doing any exercise, the discrepancies went in the opposite direction. They were giving out too little energy. The people who were fasting and exercising seemed to be having too much energy for the balance sheet. So how did they deal with this? Well, fairly simple. They got the right number of people above and below the average, then they averaged them, so it came out to 99.9% agreement with the expected value. And this became the foundational truth to which all later nutritional work refers back as the foundational proof, the last nail in the coffin of vitalism, as it was described. It wasn't challenged or really re-examined until the 1970s when an American nutritionist, Paul Webb, did some more experiments in these calorimeters. Most nutritionists only do them for a few hours nowadays. They're not trying to prove or test this hypothesis. So Paul Webb did these things and found major discrepancies. People fasting or exercising in these in his calorimeter seemed to have 25% too much energy. And some of the people who were eating too much and doing little exercise had about 25% too little. Huge discrepancies. He published his papers in the Journal of Nutrition and went around talking about these amazing discrepancies. And no one was in the slightest bit interested. Everybody knew that the law of conservation of matter and energy applied to living organisms. The vaunted skepticism of scientists doesn't apply when it might affect their cherished assumptions or beliefs. Why open up this question when everybody knows the answer? So I think this is actually a really big open question, especially since we now have medical systems where people claim there are other forms of energy, prana, qi, etc. And I think these tests should be done again in a more open-minded way. So I think this is very much an open question. rather than a solid assumption that we can use and use it as a stick to beat proponents of alternative energy medicine with, accusing them of pseudoscience and vitalism and so forth. This is their calorimeter, a box in which these subjects stayed for several days while everything was measured. The next assumption is that the laws and constants of nature are fixed. They're the same. They were the same at the moment of the Big Bang as they are today. This assumption was put in place in science in the 17th century when people assumed that God created the universe in the beginning, and because the laws were made by God, they were ideas in the divine mind. They were automatically eternal because God was eternal. In the 18th century and 19th century, most scientists thought the universe was eternal. They got rid of God by saying, well, the universe has always been there, eternal matter and energy governed by eternal laws. So the whole thing was perfectly consistent, didn't cause any problems, even though God had been removed for many scientists. But with the Big Bang, the question becomes more pressing. If the laws, if the laws and constants of nature were all fixed at the very beginning, how do we know that they? How do we know they were fixed at the beginning? Are the laws and constants of nature fixed? Were they fixed from the beginning? It's an assumption. As my friend Terence McKenna used to say, modern science is based on the principle: give us one free miracle, and we'll explain the rest. And the one free miracle is the appearance of all the matter and energy in the universe and all the laws that govern it from nowhere in a single instant. So, are they fixed? Well, if the universe is evolutionary, why shouldn't the laws evolve along with it? As soon as you ask that question, you realize the very concept of law of nature is a metaphor, an anthropocentric metaphor based on human laws. And human laws do, of course, evolve. The laws of England are different today from the way they were 100 years ago. So why shouldn't the laws evolve? Well, they can't because they're fixed. I myself think that they're more like habits. This is not an original idea. It was put forward by a number of philosophers, including Nietzsche, C.S. Peirce, and William James. And the idea that they're habits is, I think, makes much more sense of the regularities of nature. It means there's a kind of memory in nature rather than a kind of transcendent mathematical mind outside nature maintaining these eternal Platonic laws. Some philosophers of science say, oh, well, the laws aren't out there. They're just human constructions describing regularities of nature. But that amounts to saying the same as I'm saying, because the regularities evolve in an evolving universe. Therefore, the laws which express those regularities must evolve too. I'm not going to talk about the habits of nature and my theory of morphic resonance, because I've talked about that here before. And my argument is not to put forward my own views, but to critique these assumptions and turn them into questions. So I'm going to look at the constants of nature. If you actually ask the question, do the constants of nature change, and you look at the data, the answer is clearly yes, they do change. The speed of light, for example, supposedly the most gold-plated of all the constants, went down all over the world between 1928 and 1945 by about 20 kilometres per second. All over the world, people were getting low values, much lower than before, with tiny error bars. It looked as if these were very, very precise. And then they went up again after 1945. And so, does that mean the speed of light really dropped? When I discovered this fact by looking through the history of the speed of light, I went to see Dr. Brian Petley, head of metrology at the National Physical Laboratory in Teddington, to ask him about this. Petley was very, very kind to see me, and he was very open in our discussion. And I said to him, what do you make of this drop in the speed of light between 1928 and 1945 by 20 kilometres per second? He said, oh dear, he said, you've uncovered the most embarrassing incident in the history of our subject. So I said, well, how do you explain it? I said, could the speed of light have actually dropped? He said, oh no, of course not, it's a constant. I said, well then, did people just fudge their results to get the expected value so they could agree with what other people were getting? He said, well, we don't like to use that word. So I said, well, what word do you use? He said, we prefer the phrase intellectual phase locking. So anyway, we had a good discussion. As I was leaving, he reached down behind his desk and he got a cardboard box there, took out a pamphlet, and he said, by the way, you might like one of these, they've just come from the printers, the latest values of the physical constants. The one that varies most is G. Oh, I should say that this problem with light has been fixed now. In 1972, an international committee defined the speed of light. Therefore, it's no longer an empirical question. It's fixed. And they then defined the meter in terms of the speed of light. So any variation in the speed of light would lead to a change in the length of the meter, cancelling out the change in the speed of light. We're now in a hall of mirrors of a man-made definition of the facts of nature. When people got so excited recently about neutrinos supposedly moving faster than the speed of light, they were excited because they were moving faster than the assumed or defined speed of light. So maybe the speed of light isn't what's been assumed or defined anyway. I think the way they should have done an experiment is not comparing the neutrinos with the defined speed of light. They should have had a race. So what about G, big G, the gravitational constant, the oldest one in science, Newton's gravitational constant? This fluctuates even more wildly than light. In fact, it's a grave embarrassment within metrology. These are some of the best values from the top laboratories in Germany and Britain and the US and elsewhere since between 1970 and 2010. The variations in the value of G were varied by 1.5%. We're not talking tiny changes in the 10th decimal place. We're talking major discrepancies. There have been scientists like Paul Dirac who thought that G might actually change on the long scale over long periods. Very few have thought it might vary as measured on Earth over shorter time periods. One was Alfred North Whitehead, who predicted variations in G as measured on Earth. It was in his theory of relativity, which was otherwise very similar to Einstein's. The difference was he predicted variations in G, Einstein didn't. There are variations in G as measured. So are they all just errors? This is where belief and facts collide. For most people in science, they say, oh, well, they must just be errors. There must be some trivial explanation. We don't need to pay attention to the data because we know the answer already. Now something's happened and the screen's gone blank. Oh, there we are. But if we do pay attention to evidence and data, then it looks as if it varies. You'd never know it from the best values of the constants as fixed in pamphlets and in physical handbooks in labs, because what they do is they average the values in a given lab over a year or two, and then the International Committee on Metrology averages the values from different labs all around the world until they come up with the best value, which is then published as the value of the constant. Some people recently at MIT have found that the G as measured on Earth varies around the clock. They've done 24-hour measurements and found diurnal changes. Others have found seasonal changes. And people very rarely publish their day-by-day data, but the US National Bureau of Standards did. And here are the data from 1997 and 98 and 1999. You probably can't see them very well from the back, but these are daily values with error bars. And they show huge differences way outside the error range on different days. And again, there's a kind of 1.5% range just within 1998 here. Now, what's going on? Is it all errors? Or could it be that as the Earth rotates and as the whole solar system moves through the galaxy, according to dark matter hypothesis, there may be clouds of dark matter, there may be more or less at certain times, there may be other things that interfere, there may be changes in the gravitational pull of the universe on different sides of the Earth and in different directions of the galaxy, which would show up in fluctuations in the value of G. Is that what's going on? Well, I think perhaps it is, but we're not going to find out because they won't look at the data. Since 1994, I've been trying to persuade metrologists to pool the data from different labs and see whether the fluctuations are correlated. If they are, we might find something about these measurements in GE. It wouldn't challenge the very foundations of science, but it would certainly cast light on these variations, which are an embarrassment to science. But no one's done that. Why? Because they're fixed, they're constant. This is where dogmatic thinking inhibits curiosity. And there's many, many, many examples of this. This one I highlight because there's no reason, even a great fundamental theoretical reason, why one shouldn't really look in an open-minded way at these data. But that doesn't happen. I myself think the so-called constants may fluctuate within narrow ranges, maybe even chaotically. And I anticipate that one day in scientific journals like Nature, we'll have this week's report on the physical constants. G held steady this week. The charge on the electron was up by 0.0002%. The fine structure constant was slightly down, etc. Why not? Well, the belief is they're constant because they're believed to be constant because that's part of the old cosmology of an eternal universe, eternal matter, eternal energy, eternal laws, eternal constants. And scientists are driven into even greater contortions of theoretical extravagance by this. If they're all fixed at the beginning, how are they fixed just right for us to emerge and evolve? That's the anthropic cosmological principle. Some say, well, that means there must have been a creator God who fine-tuned the laws and constants just right for us. Others say, well, there's no such thing as a God, therefore what we have is billions, trillions, quadrillions of universes, all with different laws and constants. We just happen to know the one that's right for us. This is the majority view among current cosmologists, the multiverse theory. Not a shred of evidence for all these extra universes. And when you ask them, why do you believe it? I asked an eminent cosmologist a couple of years ago. He said, well, this is the most economical hypothesis because this way we can get rid of God. So I said, but surely it's the ultimate violation of Occam's razor. You shouldn't proliferate entities unnecessarily. I mean, proliferating entire universes in this way is surely an ultimate violation. He said, well, I agree there's a bit of a problem. We're working on it. They haven't even got rid of God because, as theologians have pointed out, if you have an infinite God, then he can be the God of an infinite number of universes. But this multiverse theory, which is now taken as serious science, with no evidence for it, is mainstream science. And again, if we apply skepticism to these theories of science, it doesn't hold up too well. These are things that are usually taken on faith because large parts of science are pretty immune to skeptical criticism. Now, we come to the next assumption. Nature is purposeless, which becomes the question, is nature purposeless? The reason nature is purposeless, according to this assumption, is because in the 17th century, when nature was seen as a machine, the purposes were taken out of nature and put in God or in humans. They were simply removed, cut off, and put somewhere else. Organisms have purposes, machines don't. You can see the difference if you think of a car. The car has no purpose of its own. You get into it, it'll go wherever you want to go. But if instead you got onto a horse, the horse might well have ideas of its own as to where it wanted to go and didn't want to go. It's an organism as opposed to a machine. So by using this machine metaphor and mechanistic theology, nature was drained of purpose. That's why it's purposeless in this assumption. That's why present-day materialists assume it's purposeless. It's the historical reason for this assumption. It's not based on evidence. Living organisms are very purposeful. Humans are very purposeful. And where did that come from? People say, well, it must have come from natural selection. But natural selection only works on living organisms that already have the purpose of survival and reproduction. So if nature is purposeless, let me just briefly say something about embryology. Here's on the left a normal dragonfly embryo. On the right, the embryo was tied off in the middle. The upper part of the egg was killed. The lower part of the egg developed into a small but complete embryo. There was, as it were, what is in morphogenesis research in biology is called an attractor. It's as if the thing was attracted towards the final form of the embryo, even though it started from a different point, half the lower half of the egg that would normally give just the lower half of the embryo. This is another example of development. This is a giant alga, Acetabularia. On the left is the giant alga. It's about 2 inches long. There's a single nucleus. It's a single-celled organism, a nucleus in the rhizoid area at the base. Here at the bottom, you see if you cut the whole thing off, just leave the rhizoid with the nucleus, it regenerates a complete new stem and cap, which is photosynthetic. Rather more amazing, if you cut a bit out of the stem, as you see up there on the left, that bit of stem can regenerate a whole new cap, even without a nucleus. The nucleus isn't the brains of the cell. At best, it's the gonads containing the DNA. It's not a directing influence that's controlling everything in the cell, as most people imagine, according to genetic programs. And the use of the word genetic program is an attempt to smuggle purpose back into biology. Programs are intelligently designed to fulfill particular goals or purposes. The other metaphor that biologists use is selfish genes. But again, this is an attempt to smuggle purpose back into biology. The selfish genes are supposed to mold matter, create form, behave like ruthless Chicago gangsters, according to Richard Dawkins. And so these selfish genes have been endowed with all the properties of life and mind. This is really a form of molecular vitalism. And the attempt to deny purpose has simply led to it being smuggled back into science in more or less disguised forms. Within physics, it's been smuggled back into dynamics and the concept of attractors, which are things that attract systems towards them in the virtual future. They pull things towards them and act by attraction from a future state or goal. Teleology has actually re-entered science in a big way, but people still pretend it's not there. When we come to the entire universe, does the whole evolutionary purpose have a goal or direction? Well, the normal assumption, of course not. It's just blind chance and natural selection, chance and necessity. But is that proved? No, it isn't. It's just an assumption. And there are others who see direction and purpose in the way evolution goes. Can we say they're wrong scientifically? No, we can't. We can just say it's an open question. I'm not arguing one way or the other at the moment. I'm just saying it's an open question. This assumption that nature's purposeless is a dogma, an assumption, nothing more. And when you look at it scientifically, it's no longer a certain truth. All biological inheritance is material. It's in the genes, or in epigenetic modifications of the genes. This, again, is an assumption of materialism. In the 17th and 18th centuries, materialists were opposed by vitalists, a school of biology that says that living organisms are truly alive. They're not machines. The vitalist argued that the organism was shaped by the soul. They took up Aristotle and St. Thomas's old idea of the formative soul, that the inheritance wasn't carried in material structures. The materialists said, yes, it is, and they had the idea that the egg or sperm contained miniaturized organisms, which are then simply inflated as the organism grows. It was called preformationism. That was refuted. Organisms are not preformed. So how does it work? Well, the assumption is it must all be in the genes. The genes explain everything. The genes are the key to life. That was the motive behind the Human Genome Project. Billions and billions of dollars, private and public, were spent on it. And when the genome was finally published in 2001, there was a tremendous accolade. Now we have the key to life. We understand everything about human nature in molecular terms, at least potentially. It was a terrible disappointment. The biotechnology industry has lost hundreds of billions of dollars in fruitless investment. Genes turned out to be grossly overrated. And the achievements of the Genome Project have been very, very questionable. Most of you may or may not have heard, probably haven't heard of the missing heritability problem, which is convulsing biology at the moment. The problem is that in living organisms, if you try and explain inheritance in terms of genes, What they do is they take 30,000 different genomes from 30,000 people and look at a characteristic like height. We know that height is heritable. Parents tend to be, and their children are often correlated in their height. There's about 80-90% correlation or heritability if you just measure them with a tape measure. But with 30,000 genomes, the genome-wide association studies looked at genes, and they found about 50 genes associated with height. Then they made models using these 50 genes to predict people's height on the basis of the genes. And they found they could predict their height on the basis of knowing their genes with an accuracy of 5%. Now, you can do it with an accuracy of 80% with a tape measure. You don't need to spend tens of billions of pounds on the genome project. And the gap between 5% and 80%, the 75% unexplained, is called the missing heritability problem. There's now a real debate among people in genetics. Some people like Steve Jones at University College London say that the whole project has failed and that to spend more money on this is throwing good money after bad. Billions are spent on this. Others say, well, no, there must be subtle modifier genes we haven't yet found. Give us billions more and we'll find them. Another example of promissory materialism. So there are other ways of thinking of biological inheritance. One is my own, morphic resonance, which I think accounts for a great deal of biological inheritance. In fact, I think it accounts for the missing heritability problem. But again, I'm not going to go into my own theory here because I've got several more dogmas to race through in a matter of minutes. So we're going to have to accelerate through some of these other dogmas. Dogma 7, that's the question. Memories are stored as material traces in the brain. What could be more natural? What could seem more unquestionable? Where else could they be? Not questioned. 99.999% of neuroscience is based on this assumption, an unquestioned assumption. Far from scientists saying, let's look at the evidence, is this really true? Let's try to refute this hypothesis. None of that. It's just taken for granted. Where else could they be? Well, a lot of people, including the philosopher Henri Bergson at the end of the 19th century, argued that memories are relations in time, not space, and they depend on a direct connection between the past and the present, not mediated by material traces. I myself think that memories depend on morphic resonance, a resonance across time, that they're not stored in the brain. There are other people who think the same for a variety of reasons. Now, is that possible? Well, surely, after 100 years of looking for memory traces, people have found them. Well, they haven't. It's been found by brain scans that bits of the brain, like the hippocampus, get very active when you're laying down memories. They get active when you're retrieving them. But in between, the memories just seem to disappear. They're believed to be shunted into other parts of the brain and remain ever elusive. It's rather like, say, I think the reason they haven't found them over and over again, these attempts have failed, is because they're not there. It's rather like me trying to find the memories of what you watched on TV last night by analysing your TV set. I wouldn't find residues of the programmes there. It's not how TV works. And I'm suggesting the brain's more like a TV set than a video recorder. So the assumption that memories are stored as material traces goes against the actual scientific evidence. It's been a highly unfruitful assumption in terms of finding out exactly how memories are stored. We found a lot about how they're laid down, how they're retrieved, but not how they're stored. So this too is, if we ask the question, are memories stored as material traces? It's an open question. Dogma 8, minds are inside heads. The mind is nothing but the activity of the brain. I've already mentioned this one. And this is an almost universal assumption within academic psychology. The mind's the brain. Where else could it be? What else could it be? The brain's a computer in cognitive neuroscience. The brain's a computer. The mind's just like the software running the computer of the brain. So the mind's inside the head. But this raises all sorts of philosophical problems which are now being widely discussed within consciousness studies. If the mind's inside the head, your experience is all inside your head. When you see me standing here now, Your image of me is actually inside your brain. It's a virtual reality display inside your head. That's the standard view. If you go outside and look at the moon or the sky, that's inside your head too, what you're experiencing. And as one philosopher of mind put it in a question, in the form of a question, he said, is your skull beyond the sky? The sky you experience is inside your mind, therefore it's inside your head. Your skull is beyond the sky, he argued. That's the standard position, the orthodox assumption. I'm suggesting something different, along with many other people who've thought about this, that your image of me is located where it seems to be, right here. It's in your mind, but it's not inside your brain. Our mental world, our perceptual world, is projected out all around us. Our mental world is much more extensive than our brain. I think this is testable. If your mind reaches out and, as it were, touches what you're looking at, you should be able to affect what you look at by looking at it. If you look at another person from behind, you might be able to affect them, and they might be able to feel you looking at them. Can people feel when they're being looked at from behind? Is there such a thing as the feeling of being stared at? Well, most people think there is because they've experienced it. Much research suggests there is. And I think that the reason this happens is because the mind isn't confined to the inside of the head. So when we ask the question, are minds confined to heads? This is very much an open question in modern consciousness studies. A lot of people now argue that they're not. And some people's position is called radical externalism. The mind is not just inside the head. The experiences that seem to be outside it are outside it. Of course, they depend on the brain, but they're not in the brain any more than the field of your mobile phone. It's in your phone, but when you make phone calls or receive them, there's an invisible field connecting it to transmitters that's not just inside the phone. It has a field that extends beyond it. Our minds, I think, extend beyond our heads. Psychic phenomena are illusory. Very standard assumption is the default position among educated people. And the reason they have this assumption is because if the mind is confined to the brain, the assumption I just dealt with, then intentions or attention should have no effects at a distance. Therefore, psychic phenomena like telepathy must be illusory. Now, for most materialists, this isn't a question. They must be illusory. And so if there's evidence for telepathy, most people claim to have had experiences of telepathy. Many dogs seem to be telepathic with their owners. All this evidence is dismissed, firstly, as anecdotal. Secondly, as uneducated, ill-informed, errors of judgment. And when scientists do research on this, many so-called skeptics who focus their skepticism on just these kinds of phenomena that don't fit in the materialist worldview, some of them act like, as it were, the revolutionary guards to protect the materialist revolution in science. Just assume the experiments are flawed, or anyone who reports this is fraudulent. Very simple assumption. I've come across this kind of narrow, bigoted skepticism. I come across it all the time. Some people are not like that. Chris French is my favourite skeptic, and he's what I call an informed skeptic, as opposed to a dogmatic skeptic. This is simply an assumption, a very widespread one. Most educated people feel that they ought to pretend that they don't believe in psychic phenomena, at least in public, because otherwise they won't seem as if they're educated. Uneducated people almost universally take these things for granted. So to prove you're educated, you have to think you've risen above all that, and you know that they're just coincidences, they're just frauds out there, there's mistakes in human judgment, etc. I won't go into the evidence, because again, I've talked about that before. I'll just move on to the final. Let me just say that there is now an online telepathy test you can do on mobile phones. You can access it from my website, the mobile telephone telepathy test, so do have a go. Tests are going on using that right here in Goldsmiths College. But anyone can do it at home. You don't have to come to Goldsmiths College to do it. Anyone can do it whenever you like. Mechanistic medicine is the only kind that really works. The body is a machine, the mind's nothing but the activity of the brain, therefore physics and chemistry are what medicine's about, surgery and drugs. All these other forms of therapy, Chinese traditional medicine, acupuncture, homeopathy, naturopathy, osteopathy, etc., etc., all these many alternative medicines are simply fraudulent, quackery, and if they work at all, it's just through the placebo effect. Well, the placebo effect is real and occurs in regular medicine too. So, but the problem with it is, as an explanation, that the placebo effect is the effect of belief or expectation. If the mind's nothing but the brain, it's hard to see how it could have that effect. This restrictive dogma that mechanistic medicine is the only kind that really works underlies the policy of governments everywhere. These are not just ideas that intellectuals may occasionally discuss over a glass of wine. These are ideas that affect our entire political system. The Medical Research Council has a budget of more than £1 billion a year for medical research. What percentage of that does it spend on alternative and complementary medicine? Practically zero. It has on it members of drug representatives of drug companies, and the agenda is set by the assumption that everything's mechanistic. So in medical schools, that's the usual assumption too. And the National Health Service, although there are a few small initiatives to integrate complementary medicine into it, are implacably opposed by skeptics, quackbusters and so on, who say that it's false because mechanistic medicine's the only kind that really works. There's a huge debate in China at the moment where some young Chinese educated in Western science are denouncing alternative, traditional Chinese medicine on the grounds it's unscientific and should be closed down. And then people are fighting back. This is an enormous debate. My own view is that the way to deal with this is through scientific evidence-based research. What the best way to deal with it is through comparative effectiveness research, where you have a condition, say, lower back pain or cold sores. You assign people with suffering from these at random to therapists who practice different methods. Anyone who claims to be able to treat it, they could be tested. You just find out what works. If homeopathy turned out to be the best treatment for cold sores, it would probably also be the cheapest. Then that's the best treatment. And if people say, well, it's just a placebo effect, if they can get a bigger placebo effect than anybody else and treat the condition better, that would be the treatment of choice. I think the NHS should be based on comparative effectiveness research, not an agenda that excludes a large range of therapies from the very beginning, saying they're not worthy of giving grants to them because they're just quackery. And so again, this is probably the dogma that has the greatest effect on our everyday lives and is now a huge political and economic issue because of the spiralling costs of mechanistic healthcare. So if we ask the question, is mechanistic medicine the only kind that really works? The answer is clearly no. These other systems do work. We may not know how they work, but I think the only question is, how could the different kind of medical systems be integrated with each other most effectively? So there you have it. Those are the 10 dogmas of established science, all flowing from the mechanistic and then the materialist theories. Every one of them, I think, can be examined critically and skeptically in the light of evidence, in the light of reason. And I'm totally in favour of science and reason, but I think they need to be scientific and reasonable. And I think that if we approach science, its foundational assumptions in this spirit, we don't diminish science. I think we open up science. I think all sorts of new possibilities arise. All sorts of new research becomes possible, as I show in my book, The Science Delusion. And the I think that science, when we question these dogmas, when we start doing science without taking them for granted, I think science will become more interesting, much freer, much more fun. And I think it would be better for scientists as well as for everybody else. They'll be able to speak freely to their colleagues. Right now, they tend to, if they've had psychic experiences or been to alternative therapists, many of them don't want to tell their colleagues because they think they'll be shocked. I think the way forward for science is really, the model for us should be the gay liberation movement. That science is full of closet holists, people who've had psychic experiences, miraculous healings, or other encounters with alternative medicine. When scientists feel free to come out and talk about these experiences with each other, the atmosphere of science labs would become much more fun, science would become much more open, and I think it would be much more attractive to young people as well. Thank you.